Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on the Conversation. It's Aloha Friday, March 6. A key emergency access road is insured for Oahu's west side. We hear from the Army about the importance of working with communities here and across the Pacific. No one wants an invasive pest in their neighborhood, and the state agriculture department has been taking heat over whether it's been doing its job. What officials say is misunderstood about the import of lightly infested goods. And we take a closer look at the Maui Food Bank that is looking to expand its facilities. And we also hear from Hawaii's new poet laureate, who looks to uplift underrepresented voices with humor and pigeon. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Oahu's west side community has long had a need for an emergency access road, and in the past that has meant cutting across military property. And it wasn't until the Lahaina wildfires that talks about making that access to Kolikoli Pass official, and it rose to the top. Army Commander Lance Okamura was on hand for a signing event this week. The Kamehameha School's graduate serves as the Deputy Commanding General for Homeland Affairs, and he talked to us this morning about the Army's efforts to take the community's wishes to heart here in Hawaii as well as across the Pacific region.
It was really a wonderful symbol of unity and working together. And we've always had this agreement since 2001, but I think it was really brought to light as a result of the Maui wildfires. And so I'll be honest, after the Maui wildfires, the folks from the Moku Kupuna Council on the west side actually reached out to me and voiced their concerns. And so I went to a local meeting and I said, we've always had this agreement. Why don't we just exercise this agreement as a result of this, highlighting the importance of enabling the community to find an emergency access, knowing full well that there is a natural disaster, whether it's a wildfire, tsunami, Farrington Highway would be just cluttered with traffic. And so this Kolikoli Pass was definitely a needed emergency route. So I reached out to U.S. Army Garrison and obviously also reached out to the Department of Navy, specifically the commander of Pearl Harbor, knowing they own the Lu'ulua Lei side. And I said, hey, I think just come to this meeting and hear the community members voice their concerns. And as a result of that, I think it just blossomed into, hey, let's conduct an exercise. And between Captain Smokey White and Colonel Rachel Sullivan, they started this exercise last year. They exercised it again this year. But to memorialize this community effort, they decided to have that signing ceremony. So beautiful, beautiful symbol of just being neighborly, knowing full well that we as military members, we live in the community, we are their neighbors, and so we have a responsibility to be neighborly and look after the safety and health and welfare of our neighbors.
Well, you know, I have to admit, in my previous life as a television reporter, I remember going on that emergency bypass road when there was an issue with Farrington. And it's just a gorgeous road. It's beautiful. It reminded me so much of being on the, you know, neighbor islands. But just as we were coming out on the other end, we got an alert saying Kolikoli Pass has been closed because of a landslide. And maintenance, I think, was an issue a long time ago. But how do we safeguard the public from those kinds of threats?
Well, we're also working very closely with Ed Sniffen, right, Department of Transportation, to enable the reconstruction and repair of that road. So obviously we still want to use it as an emergency access. And so we actually have assigned personnel from the military who will be at those junctions where we think is of high risk until we can get that road fully repaired. So that's why the exercise was so important, right? How do we demonstrate that we can actually use this road for real world purposes? And so part of that exercise was like, how do we enable members of the community to safely travel through that road? And so we've put a lot of mitigating measures of personnel and patrols to ensure that when people come to a risky area of that road, we make sure that they're traveling safely, slowly, knowing full well that we don't want to create another disaster as a result of responding and evacuating from another disaster. Does that make sense?
Yes. And I think it's just listening to the community, right, that's important, and just finding a way through whatever the impediments were in getting just something formalized like this.
You know what? Another really second effect of this Kole Kole Pass ceremony and exercise was identifying that there are key symbols of Hawaiian ancestry that are located on Lu'ulu'ule and Schofield Barracks, right? So you have people like Uncle William Ila and Auntie Lynette Cruz, who are finding that there's significant historical findings and symbols, heiaus and altars of that nature. So it's also a really great opportunity for us as a military, Army and Navy, to enable community members for cultural purposes to have access to these very meaningful locations on either Lu'ulu'ule or Schofield Barracks. We feel it's our responsibility to do so.
And I understand that you will be heading out across the Pacific next week. I had the opportunity to talk to President Whips, the president of Palau, at a recent East-West Center summit. And we know that the military is looking to improve relations to those island nations out there. What do you expect to do out in Palau this trip?
I'm actually glad you brought up President Whips. Actually, I'm going to be meeting with President Whips along with his national security coordinator, Ms. Jen Anson. In addition to that, we're also going to meet with Ambassador Aaron Reich, our U.S. ambassador. And it's really, how do we come to a shared understanding of, well, how can the U.S. Army, how can the theater army of the Pacific contribute to the safety, health, welfare, and national security for the people and communities of Palau, right? Obviously, Palau culturally has close ties with us here in Hawaii, but from a national security perspective, there's a shared history from World War II. And if people look at World War II history, Palau was a key location, key terrain by which the United States was able to operate from. And so knowing full well that we have a responsibility since World War II to be neighborly, to be able to make sure that we are fulfilling our obligations and commitments to the president of Palau and to the people of Palau, we also have a responsibility to identify what are their security concerns and how do we contribute along with the rest of the United States government to the health, security, welfare for the people of Palau. So that's what we're doing. I mean, we've been doing this for, I think, 2 years now, whether it's law enforcement, whether it's health concerns, whether it's engineering, whether it's education. We're trying to be part of that whole of government approach in supporting the needs, concerns, and security challenges for Palau.
Can you point to something specific that you've been working with them on?
Yeah. One of the big things that they have concern is law enforcement capacity. And so, you know, obviously, you know, the Bureau of Public Security is one of their primary agencies to reinforce security within the communities of Palau. And so we actually have a member of our Oceanic Engagement Team who, civilian career, he used to be a police officer, but his Army career is also, he's a military police officer. So he's taking his expertise, his experience, and working with the Bureau of Public Safety to ensure that they're properly trained, they're properly equipped. And one of the big initiatives that he's been working on is the establishment of an official police academy so that they can have formalized training, formalized curriculum, so that when the, I guess you call them police officers, graduate, they're prepared to deal with the security challenges and criminal enterprises that they'll have to face as a member of the Bureau of Public Security. I think another really important feature is it's always been highlighted to us as a result of the non-communicable diseases that are plaguing the people of Palau. So part of our ocean engagement team, we actually have a doctor for a civilian career, but as an Army officer, she's a physician assistant. So she's been walking around to the hospitals, working with the doctors, working with the nurses, actually working at the schools for the inoculation and education, health and welfare, to ensure that the people of Palau are actually safe, healthy, and are able to operate, knowing full well that health and medical support is a requirement. Does that make sense?
Yes. And, you know, I know when we talked to President Whips, he was highlighting the issue with the monkeys, that he said they're trying to find a solution to deal with the invasive species on that one island. I don't know if the military is involved in that, or is that just going to be a private sector thing?
Oh, that's actually a good question. I'll be honest, I don't know the exact details of that particular subject. I can share with you, though, if the military is involved, we have a really good cadre of veterinarians within the Theater Army here in the Pacific. Those veterinarians have been very supportive of prison whips. In the past, when we talk about the police dogs that they just secured recently, and in addition to having trainers for the dogs, the health and the health care and welfare of those dogs is really important. So we've been deploying veterinarians out of the Theater Army to make sure that those dogs remain healthy in support of those operations. So I think that's just an example of the other avenue of support that the Army provides is, you know, when people think about the Army, they think about a soldier with weapons and things of that nature. We have other skills within the Army that people just don't take advantage of that we want to deploy and ensure we're doing our goodwill for the people across the Pacific.
Well, I know that there was that commitment to help rebuild the hospital there in Palau, which would mean improving the care for the veterans that live there on Palau.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it was my last visit where they gathered a large contingent of veterans at their college, and they were able to sit down with me. We are not part of the Department of Veteran Affairs, but as a military member wearing that uniform, I was able to relay that back to the Department of Veteran Affairs to ensure that whether it's veteran health care, veteran benefits, are actually being addressed to the people of Palau. Because if you track correctly, if I didn't know this, but when you look at Palau, Federal States of Micronesia, and the Republic of Marshall Islands, per capita, the people that volunteered to serve in the United States military, it's extremely high. And so, to me, that shows their commitment to the United States. And as a result, we want to show a commitment back to them by taking care of them, knowing full well that they served many years and sacrificed for the United States.
All right. Well, thank you so much, General, for your time this morning.
No, thank you for your time. I'm glad you brought all of these topics up because, you know, my portfolio includes the Oceania subregion and the Pacific Island countries. And so I travel out on a very routine basis to all these countries to ensure that we're establishing strong relationships and partnerships with them because of our shared history and our shared value.
We've been hearing from Army General Lance Okumura, who we spoke to this morning, about strengthening community relations here in Hawaii and across the Pacific region.
Support for HPR comes from Leeward Theatre. New Zealand contemporary dance company Black Grace performs an immersive experience for the family March 13th. Tickets at leeward.hawaii.edu/theatre.
It's been just 8 months since the State Agriculture Department added biosecurity to its name. It was meant to reflect its responsibility to keep invasive species from invading our shores, but the department has been under fire from lawmakers on its efforts to stop the spread of pests like coconut rhinoceros beetle. We sat down with Director and Board Chair Sharon Hurd and Plant Quarantine Manager Jonathan Ho for a candid conversation about whether it's falling short of doing its job. The department has long struggled with understaffing and lack of funding. Hurd admits the department can and should do better, but is asking lawmakers for time to make needed changes now that it's had its budget increased.
2024 was the very first year we actually got a big tranche, you know, appropriation. It was $10 million. That is more money than we've ever had before. So we've had the past year maybe to really implement and make some progress with attacking invasive species, or I think the word that we want to use is control and mitigate, prevent, control, mitigate, eventually eradicate. And so we do need those resources. The message for this session, though, is that we could do better, yes, but the statute says that the inspectors, we have the authority. The laws give the Department of Agriculture the authority to inspect all incoming cargo, and according to the discretion of the inspectors, they can implement the laws of the land to prevent the entry of invasives. So discretion is a really broad term, and it is based on years of experience with the knowledge of what to look for, what could be, what's already here, what might not be here, what's suspicious. And so they do have data that they can kind of like separate the higher risk products that are coming in. And with that, they use their discretion and quarantine, destroy what they think is not known to occur, and on and on. I don't know if this is a good comparison, but for instance, the police officers, they have the discretion as well to implement the laws of the land. And we know that the speed limit is 55 and 25 in a school zone, or 20 in some communities, but they have the discretion, you know, to see what is risky, what is possibly going to lead to more than just going a few miles over the speed limit, you might say. So in that sense, the laws give government agencies discretion. And that's what I would like to say is the message that we would like to say. Thank you for the resources you've given us, but we have the laws to give us the discretion to implement them.
Well, we know that your name did change, right? They added biosecurity in there. Mm-hmm. And it reflects the concern that people have because we have so many invasive species that have come into our state. And Jonathan, maybe you should talk about, you know, what it's been like with this new emphasis.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of things. And I think, you know, to the extent of like what we do, there's this idea that we inspect, or there's a need to inspect everything. And the statute has a clear definition of the things that are inspected. So it's kind of a long list. And there's these ideas that we can't inspect other things. And we do have authority. And I think going back to what we're trying to do with, or what the legislature is trying to do, is to get more done. And I think one of the things that I think a lot of people are kind of missing is the idea of to do more, like as Chair said, with the lack of resources. You know, invasive species and pests are a constant pressure to the state. And the ability to have discretion, and discretion isn't all-encompassing. It's not like every inspector can just do whatever they want. They have discretion is not unlimited. But for, again, specific types of things, you need discretion. And a lot of the issues as it relates to like some of the measures that are being put forth, it's like everything is prohibited, everything requires treatments. And trying to manage the ability to do the work that needs to be done to protect the state from the next, you know, coconut rhinoceros beetle or whatever that may be, versus ensuring, you know, obviously commerce, people having the ability to eat, right? We import like 90% of our food. And, you know, the cost of living is very high. Treating or destroying or refusing everything that has anything on it, whether it's good, bad, negligible, creates these added costs that can get pushed down the line. And like as Chair said, getting to that point of preventing pests, the best way to do that and the most absolute way to do that is to not import, right? And so how do you do that? Realistically, the best way to do it is to promote the growth of agriculture in the state. Obviously, we can't grow everything that we eat, but focusing on the things that we are able to grow and make sure that they can be done well so that they're competitive, and then there's no reliance on importation.
Well, and, you know, yeah. I think the lawmakers, you know, have expressed some concern about whether our inspectors are letting what lightly infested cargo come in, and I think they're getting kind of squeamish about that.
Yeah, and you know, and I think there's been a little bit of a misunderstanding, I think, to the extent of that lightly infested is I think when you hear it, it sounds terrible because there's no quantifier built to it. So that lightly infested term, or I guess that example that was used for an organism that is widespread throughout the state. It's already here. And to require treatment or destruction of that or refusal of that particular commodity really wouldn't push the you know, the ball toward what we need to do because it's here already. But again, going back to that idea of like, what is high priority and which things there are. Like, for example, we had CRB. We won't see CRB on you know, in imported shipment because the continental United States doesn't have coconut rhinoceros beetle. but you know, high priority pests, treat, destroy, refuse.
Right.
So well, there's that.
You know, I grew up in Guam, and yes. You know, we've had to deal with invasives, the brown tree snake. So I've seen what they've done to Guam's bird population, and the CRB with the coconut rhinoceros beetle attacking our trees.
Yes.
And you know, Guam prizes its coconut trees very dearly, and they're having a heck of a time with this. And so, yeah, we don't want to see what happened to the birds and the trees happen here.
Yeah, you know, so for example, I'm using brown tree snake. You know, so we have a program that's going on for decades to do inspections for brown tree snake. We do, you know, pretty much any place that has brown tree snake known to be established, we're inspecting. The feds have a program as well for that. And, you know, I think as it relates to the entry of pests, I think one of the things that I think gets lost a lot of times in I think a lot of the discussions is Hawaii is a state and we're essentially kind of constrained by federalism. So a lot of the pests that are of like, you know, I think people hear about, right? So you figure, I think like CRB, Koki frog. So CRB likely came from Guam. For entry, Guam is considered foreign, so we have no jurisdiction. Koki frog, Puerto Rico, same thing, considered foreign. Another big one that's kind of on the rise is Queensland longhorn beetle from Australia, no jurisdiction. And then little fire ant. Possible that it came from Florida. It's also possible it came from South America. So I think that portion, the state can never create enough regulation to get past the federalism. And I think a lot of times people will think about like, oh, we should be like New Zealand. We're an island and all of that stuff. And I'm in agreement that there's a lot to learn from them. You know, they've been at it. They're big biosecurity stuff. They're 35 years ahead of us. And they have come up with a lot of systems that, again, the state is trying to implement. But they're a country.
Right. And they grow more things than we do, right? I mean, Sharon, you were in New Zealand, right? Did you go with that contingent?
And they do have – they have invasives, you know, and they do a real good job controlling it. But to Jonathan's point, they're a nation. So they can make laws that are the laws of the land. We can make laws, but they're the laws of the state. Then we are preempted by the laws of the land. So that's a – challenge for
big
us.
Big difference, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But then, to that point, the federal agencies are helping us. I mean, they do fund our brown tree snake programs, and they have funded CRB.
Well, the one that gives me the heebie-jeebies is the fire ant. And I know, Sharon, that the department has come under criticism about, oh, you're giving too much deference or favoring the nursery industry when it comes to letting people know where this stuff is taking hold or where you found it. And I remember battling with the health department decades ago about inspection reports about, you know, whose restaurant is clean and who's flunking the inspections. Mm-hmm. And that was all kept very private. And where I grew up in Guam, they published, you know, those reports in the paper every Friday, you know, what restaurants got an F or a C or what passed. And so I don't know, how do you respond to that criticism? Are we protecting the industry too much?
You know, we've been accused of that, but it should be known that invasives come in on everything. We've recently decided or got evidence that skunks and possums come in on cars. Ants come in on everything. They come in on construction material. They're on wood. They're in between bricks. They're everywhere, right? To the industry's credit, though, going back to something the manager host said, New Zealand has something they call government industry assistance agreements. The flower industry has been the first one to step up and say, hey, and what that is boots on the ground. If there's an outbreak of an invasive, we have our staff and we have the Hawaii Invasive Species Councils and the local county invasive species, but that's maybe a total of 60 people we can deploy at any given moment. The industry, on the other hand, has about 600 that they've agreed, we're in the agreement process right now in a pilot program, that if there's an invasive that we've discovered, maybe a new one, they're going through training, they're signing agreements that they're willing to be trained by Jonathan's staff, they're going to be provided with the PPE that they need, and if they have the equipment that would help us, they've agreed to provide that, they'll be trained. And together with this cadre of people, this rapid response team, they can delimit the area, work inside. So the industry understands that they've been singled out, but they want to be part of the solution.
Yeah, but, you know, I guess I go back to the health department now puts out press releases when they shut down a restaurant like they did, you know, across the way here from our studios, that they disclose it. That folks know, okay, I think I bought a plant from this nursery, you know, in Waimanalo or Kailua or wherever. But just to be able to get it on people's radar to, hey, double check.
Yeah, so I think I understand, I think, a lot of that anxiousness about that, or maybe not the anxiousness, I guess the idea that, oh, the department wants to protect all these guys. And they're quite heavily regulated as it relates to movement, inspections and things like that. And, you know, so for example, one of the things that was done by the legislature is the biosecurity website. So it's biosecurity.hawaii.gov. We are now taking geolocation stuff and we have maps and people can go on to it. It's been in place for like maybe 4 months. Again, work in progress. We hired a person to manage the website and we're working with all the folks that do that work to get, like, I think that information out there, right, to people. And I think to the extent of, I think, how much more we can give, I'm sure there's more that can be done. But I think right now it's I think, trying to put together all the things that are being done and making sure that they're in one place so everybody knows what's going on. Because I think one of the challenges is that there's a lot of folks that are in the game. And I think to circle back to what Chair said, resources or manpower is one of the, I think, the biggest challenges. And when you think about, I think, invasive species and pests, they're kind of ongoing, right, mm-hmm. in the environment. And I think, you know, like, so for example, to the extent, I think there's been a lot of previous talk about, you know, doing like a placarding system and, you know, making sure that these guys are completely free of pests and all of these things. And I think one of the challenges is like, the comparison is, right, DOH, right? They have a placard mm-hmm. and then you can make it the same. And the intent is very similar, but I think the pressure is very different. A nursery can do whatever they can do. And if your neighbor, who may not necessarily be an agriculture person, it could be the state, right? They're infesting you. And so how do you, I guess, reconcile that? I think to the extent of trying to manage the movement and the spread of the pest against, I think, making sure that these guys are able to do business. And I think to the extent of the nursery industry, there's no question, or I guess people that grow stuff, there's no question that those folks understand that pathway is higher mm-hmm. risk, right? You know, the pests.
Right, but you want buy-in from these nurseries or the floral industry or whoever in order to reach the goal. You want to reduce the spread and mm-hmm. eliminate and eradicate the threat.
Absolutely, and they're more than willing to do that. As Jonathan said, the protocols are in place. We okay. check everything. Those are high risk. We check that.
I know lawmakers are trying to take away some of the responsibilities and move them into DLNR. Anything you want to say about that?
I do want to say that biosecurity is a big deal. Thank you for giving the Department of Agriculture Biosecurity the responsibility, tip of the spear. Give us time. Time is everything that we need. Biosecurity, we're extending not only to plants, but we want to do biosecurity threats from animals as well.
That was Sharon Hurd, Chair of the Department of Agriculture and Biosecurity, and Jonathan Ho with the Plant Quarantine Division, who we sat down with yesterday afternoon. Now it's time for us to reach into our mailbag. We heard from many of you after our conversation with Mark Glick of the state's energy office. Our discussion about how the war in Iran has pushed up oil prices spurred Stacey Alapai to write, "Relying on imported fuel will always make us vulnerable to volatility. Doesn't matter what kind of fuel that is." And Angelus Rios sent this in, sharing this with Aloha because these conversations matter to our islands. A recent interview touched on Hawaii's energy future, and while the intent was good, a few things deserve a deeper look. EV drivers here aren't as shielded from oil prices as people think hydrogen keeps coming up as a solution. But let's be honest, most hydrogen today is still produced from fossil fuels. Hawaii already has real local clean energy answers. Geothermal, properly maintained and managed, is firm 24/7 power sitting right beneath our feet. Hydro and solar round out that beautifully. These are island-rooted solutions. True energy sovereignty for Hawaii means local ownership, local benefit, and local decision-making. Malama Aina starts with who controls the power. And Representative Amy Peruso had this to say: someone should ask if this changes the projections made in the alternate fuels report with respect to the feasibility of liquefied natural gas, which also just got much more expensive. And David Harrington shared this: Alaska has contracts to provide natural gas to Japan and South Korea. Taiwan will probably sign up. Have any of your representatives discussed Alaska natural gas? It's called economy of scale. Thank you all for the feedback. Call our talkback line. Record something, 808-792-8217, to share your thoughts. You can also find HPR on Facebook or Instagram.
Support for HPR comes from the Maui Arts and Cultural Center. New Zealand contemporary dance group Black Grace performs Sunday, fusing Samoan and Maori cultural traditions and modern dance. Tickets at mauiarts.org.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we hear about a recent book chronicling Hawaii's underground music scene. The book is called Local Unrest, and it harkens back to the late 70s at a time, dare I say, was pre-digital. That's this evening at 6:30 on Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for HPR comes from the Olson Trust, with a mission to support growing sustainable agriculture, protecting natural resources, and investing in Hawaii's people. OlsonTrust.com.
Turn our attention now from energy to food. HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel joins us now with a fresh look at the Maui Food Bank. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so what got this on your radar?
Yeah, so the Maui Food Bank just bought 8 acres in central Maui. It was a $9.25 million purchase. And they are going to be building a centralized, what they're calling a centralized campus, for food storage and distribution, that will increase their capabilities to get food out into the community and also for emergency resiliency and preparedness. Lisa Paulson is CEO of the Maui Food Bank. She's been there since August 2024, but says this isn't a new plan. This has been in the process for almost a decade now. They've had community consultations and a lot of strategic planning to make this happen. The Maui Food Bank has grown so much in recent years that they now rent 3 different facilities across Maui to provide all of the services that they offer. And this new campus, which is in the early planning stages at this point, like I said, they just bought the land, which is a big step, but it will combine all of those facilities into one space. And one of their biggest needs is fridge and freezer capability. She talked a lot about, you know, the just shortage of storage space. And this facility will also serve, as I mentioned, as kind of an emergency resiliency resource for the community. Here, Lisa Paulson explains.
Chiller and freezer space is it's a finite commodity in the islands. I mean, when we run out of space or our chiller goes down, we frantically are calling, you know, VIP Foods, Costco, you name it. Hey, do you have any space? So just having that expanded space alone will allow us to have more on hand to respond to any increased economic emergency or, you know, natural disaster. I think, too, this facility will be all state of the art and everything will be backed up with generators, PV panels. And so our campus will be fully secure in being able to handle keeping those chillers and freezers running for well into, you know, week two, week three after a disaster.
That's very good that they're, you know, planning for solar and generators before, you know, this thing gets built.
Absolutely. It seems like a lot of thought and planning has gone into it. And she talked about the huge need for food in the community that's really ongoing. You know, it hasn't seen a decrease after the fires as of now. So in 2025 fiscal year, the Maui Food Bank distributed 7.6 million pounds of food across Maui County. And that's, she says, the equivalent to about 17,000 meals per day. So it's really a mind-boggling amount of food that they have been distributing to the community. And that includes almost 40% fresh produce that is grown by farmers and ranchers across Maui County. So they're also working to increase that support of local food production that will be augmented by this additional chill space to be able to bring people not only, you know, canned and shelf-stable food, but also that fresh produce, which, you know, for people in need is often really tough. During the pandemic, they saw a spike in need, and then it kind of decreased afterwards as far as, you know, people just really needing that food. And after the fire, she says the need for food has remained really steady, the same numbers now they've been seeing, you know, since about 2023. And a report at the end of last year commissioned by food banks across the state showed that one-third of Hawaii households are food insecure, and that's over 40% for Maui County specifically, even greater need in Maui County. So, you know, just a lot of need for food. Families, you know, sacrificing food for money for food, you know, to go towards rent and other expenses instead. So the Maui Food Bank also serves Molokai and Lanai, and Paulton talks about how the new Maui campus will also help those islands and some of their long-term goals.
In tandem with this project, we are looking at disaster resiliency for Molokai and Lanai as well, working with our federal partners in achieving some storage facilities on each island so that they have disaster resiliency as well. Currently, when we have shipments arrive on either one of those islands, our volunteers, our amazing volunteers, go to the dock, gather the goods, and distribute it immediately because they have no facility, they have no place to store and then distribute out. Just a little fun fact is we are the only food bank in the United States that distributes to our agency partners over water. It would also increase our capabilities of accepting more donated and purchased local products from our farmers and our ranchers. And so that's an added component to this facility that we're really looking forward to being able to. We already work with 29 farmers and ranchers, and we want to expand that.
So what's the timeline? When are they planning to complete this?
Yeah, so a few phases. The first main facility they're looking to complete by 2030. A lot of building material delays and those kinds of things, but they're working toward that goal, early stages, phases of planning right now.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've been talking with HPR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel. Find your story online at hawaiipublicradio.org. Poetry and Pigeon, a match made in Hawaii. Many know Lee Tonouchi as the Pigeon Gorilla. Well, he now has a new title, State Poet Laureate. Tonouchi will spend the next 3 years traveling around the islands for readings and workshops. He recently stopped by our studios and spoke with the Conversation's Kevin Allen about his career spent advocating for pigeon. Tonouchi starts by reading his poem entitled Pigeon on Trial.
I don't talk pigeon, But oh, you just did, so why try to get rid of something that's some part of you? I know. Since Hanabara days, the condition was classic. You can go bathroom, but depends how you enact it. May I please use the restroom? That's how you gotta tell for keep the teacher from yelling at you. But what if you never do as you was told and your bladder would explode? Bruh, you might be dead, but at least your parents could have sued the Department of Ed. Pigeon went to try once, but we wasn't winners. We super qualified, but they gave our positions to beginners from the mainland, cause can't understand. Somehow more better, the judge and go explain. We thought we had them when the language testifier would argue for a higher improve. Linguistically, we speak like Wahe, Katano, and several government officials. We thought we could beat the friggin' language prejudicials, but I don't know who we was fooling. What this National Weather Service ruling meant was even professionals who had schooling wasn't safe. Cause after the case was filed, people heard us talking on the news. They was all like, wow, the pigeon not even full on, like, you know, let at the kinds. In fact, their pigeon sound like can be mines. Sound like can be mines.
You just read us a wonderful poem. Can you tell us the name of it and kind of really, I guess, what it's about?
So Pigeon on Trial was, I guess, influenced by the real life case of the one and only time that pigeon discrimination did go to trial. It was in 1987 when the three guys from the National Weather Service here, they was denied promotion because of their pigeon accents. Instead, the jobs went to these three guys from the continent who were straight out of college. They had no job experience, yeah, so they was way less qualified. But the National Weather Service just said, oh, they, quote, sounded better. So then, like, a linguist from UH, Charlene Sato, she analyzed all the tape recordings, and then she would go testify, yeah, that the local National Weather Service guys, they talk same, like our then-governor or then-lieutenant-governor. They talk the same, like several members of the Board of Education. But they still ended up losing the case. And then later on, like after the case was filed, and then like the guys went on the news and they went on top of the radio, local professional people who maybe they wasn't sympathetic at first, I think they came maybe a little bit more sympathetic later because they heard the guys and they was like, oh, what she mean they talk pigeon, right? Because they just had pigeon accents, right? Yeah, so you had all these professional doctors and lawyers saying, you know, maybe at first they never identified themselves as pigeon talkers, but hearing those guys talk, they was like, wow, that means I can be classified as one pigeon talker too, yeah? That person could be me.
And it's kind of a scary thought because, I mean, pigeon here, it's so ubiquitous in the culture. It's something that a lot of us kind of grow up talking and speaking, and then kind of when you get, you know, further along your lines, you start going to higher education, you start working in offices, it's weird, you kind of stop hearing it as much. Is that some kind of notes that you're trying to hit on with that poem? Or, I mean, just kind of your work as a pigeon gorilla?
I think a lot of times, like, I think a lot of people who talk pigeon, but I think they might be scared for boss them out first. Yeah. I remember when I was teaching, like, a lot of my fellow teachers would say, oh, yeah, you know, I don't really hear pigeon nowadays, yeah, Lee. But I'm thinking, oh, if you know boss them out, that's probably why they're not going to boss them out too, right? Yeah.
And you're kind of busting it out in a in a major way as the new Hawaii State Poet Laureate.
Oh, that's one smooth transition.
You like that,
Kevin? Good at you.
How did it feel to hear that you were going to become the Hawaii State Poet Laureate for 2026 to 2029?
Felt exciting and also a little bit daunting because get plenty of work for do. I was like, they're going to put me to work. Yeah. So growing up, I never thought I could be one writer. Right? I never dreamed I could ever be one poet. Always growing up, I was told that my voice no was good enough, right? Like teachers always say, oh, Lee, you write like how you talk, right? Said, oh, that's good, huh? And they said, no, that's not good, right? But then, you know, yet in the real world, I hear all these words that exist, yeah? You know, like the kind, yeah? Try like Bombay, Hamajang. But then I was wondering, oh, how come when I write, how come we cannot use all these words, right? They exist. So writing always felt like, oh, that's for fake, right? Because the real world has pigeon. I remember I would write stories for fun, like for my friends. I would spell stuff like H-A-K-U-M. And then my friends would look at that, what is that, H-A? Then they say, oh, how come? Yeah, we don't say how come. we say, how come? Like, how come, how come? I stay, you go. Yeah. Yeah, so my goal is for try and reach the voices that's marginalized. Yeah, like the voices. Not, that doesn't necessarily have to be what I call a pigeon voice, but just the people who never dreamed that they could be writers, kind of like me. Yeah.
And I think it's really neat that you brought up how you wanted to write like how you spoke. And I think that's kind of one of the beautiful aspects about creative writing and poetry is that there is kind of that medium, that space there where you actually can be and write and speak like how you are. Tell me a little bit, maybe, is that what brought you to that kind of creative writing or?
Oh, that was just stage one, yeah, Kevin. Oh, so it wasn't until I was in college, first time seeing pigeon in writing. I was taking English 256, poetry and drama from Rob Wilson. Yeah, so Rob Wilson, he wasn't from over here, but then he felt that it was important for use local literature as part of his curriculum. So he was using Shakespeare, he was using Faulkner, but he also had one textbook called The Best of Bamboo Ridge. And inside of Best of Bamboo Ridge, had a pigeon poem, yeah, called Tutu on the Curb by Eric Chalk. So as a young college student, I was blown away, bro. I was like, wow, get guys writing in pigeon. We're studying them in college, right? Oh, that means you got to be smart, bro, for study pigeon. Yeah, so that kind of led me on my path. And I was very fortunate because a lot of my classmates and my roommates and friends, they went all through college at UH and they had zero local literature. It just so happens I took class from that one right professor. Yeah, so I started taking creative writing courses too because I wanted to try to write like Eric Chalk, right? And then eventually I took a playwriting course. And then eventually I was like, you know, if I can do all my creative stuff in pigeon, how come I not can do all my critical stuff too? Yeah, I would do short response papers in pigeon. Eventually I would do 30-page research papers all in pigeon, master's thesis, everything full on pigeon, right? Yeah.
Can you kind of tell me a little bit more about, I mean, maybe why you think pigeon can be such a strong tool, not only just to kind of connect with people, but in this kind of creative writing formula or format as well?
Probably pigeons, they're more relatable, yeah, because that's our language. I remember when I have to defend my master's thesis, I have to cite who was my influences, right? And everybody else had all these fancy big name literary writers as like their influences, right? But I never have such influences because I never thought I was going to be one writer, right? So for me, my influences was, you know, local comedy. So I said, I went argue that, this is like for my thesis defense, right? I went argue that local comedy was what influenced my work, right? So Booga Booga, Rap Replinger, Andy Bumatai, yeah, that's what influenced me. So I think pigeon in writing, in theory, would be more relatable for pigeon speakers. But then, yet, funnily, my grandma, right, she's like the biggest pigeon talker, yet she had the hardest time reading my pigeon work, right? Like she wanted to read my books, but most people not used to, right, reading pigeon, yeah? But it really helped, like, when she tried to read them out loud, yeah.
That is an interesting angle to bring up, reading pigeon, yeah? It's kind of always been maybe a spoken form, but it's so different to read it on paper. Were there other cases like that where people were having maybe even like, again, pigeon speakers, but trying to read pigeon was kind of just a whole different ballgame?
I had this one story one time. This dad came up to me and then he introduced the son. The son was probably around maybe 6-7 years old. And then the son absolutely, he refused to read anything. Yeah, he never like learned how to read. Yeah, so every book they tried at school, the kid refused to learn. So the father went go try reading my pigeon short story collection to him, right? And then the son actually wanted to try and read my book. Yeah, so my book, The Word, was actually his first book that he actually tried to read on his own. I was like, wow, that's kind of neat, yeah.
And I think it's really neat. Just again, kind of coming back to now your role as the Hawaii State Poet Laureate. Kind of what you can do for the community and how you can, you know, reach such a wide audience. You know, you're in the role for 3 years. Have you thought about what you're going to do? You said it's going to be busy.
Going to get a lot of travel to all the neighbor islands, yeah? So I think one of the islands they went to mention first was we should try to go visit Lanai, yeah? Because that's an island that people often neglect, they said. But it's going to be interesting for here all the different varieties of pigeon. I heard from my friend Thomas, I heard that they get real old school pigeon over there. I don't know if we can get to Ni'ihau, but I think that would be like really trippy if we can go. Probably like go Maui, yeah, my family from Maui, probably want to go Kona Sai, Hilo Sai.
Yeah. And I like the idea, too, of old school pigeon. Yeah, I think that's something that I had heard from, you know, random uncles saying, like, yeah, we used to speak pigeon. You guys don't even know half of these words anymore.
That's true.
Is it interesting how pigeon is just kind of like evolving as a language? You know, I think there's like new words being picked up and old words being forgotten. It's almost kind of this living thing.
Yes, when I go from school to schools, I like to ask them, oh, you guys can try teach me some words specific to your area, right? So I remember when I went to Kalihi, I'm going to talk to the kids at Farrington. I say, oh, you guys can try teach me some Farrington pigeon or what, right? And so like they think about it a little while and then they say, oh, okay. So instead of saying that's how at Farrington, they tell that's the how. Okay, yeah. And then I heard like this other one where Hilo guys, so Hilo guys is very polite peoples, right? But then when they drive, they come a little bit gangster. So then if you're following behind a car and it's going slow, yeah, most times you would say, oh, let us speed up and overtake the car. Yeah, let's overtake the car. But in Hilo, yeah, they don't overtake the car. They say, hey, the guy driving slow. We got to take over the car. Yeah, so they take over the car, yeah, over there.
In a perfect world, 30 years from now, how do you hope pigeon is being more incorporated or represented well, or what are your dreams for pigeon?
So I think the previous generation, like, they was just happy, I forget, pigeon as part of like the Hawaii writers class to be part of the curriculum. I went to go start the first ever pigeon literature course at HPU, right? So that was a course that was solely devoted all to pigeon literature, right? Probably in the future, I think one future goal might be for have like one whole pigeon program, yeah, where you can get your whole PhD in pigeon. Yeah, that's like one, I don't know how much future that, that's like future, maybe my great-great-grandchildren maybe, I don't know.
That was Hawaii's new state poet laureate, Lee Tonouchi, and HPR's Kevin Allen. Tonouchi says he would like to uplift marginalized communities as the new state poet laureate, from pigeon speakers to immigrants and the LGBTQ community. You can find links to his short stories and poetry on our website. That's it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we plan to check in with our congressional delegation on the fast-moving political developments here at home and abroad. Call our talkback line, record your comments, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. Our program's produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and Kevin Allen, with support from Savannah Harwin-Pote and the HPR digital team. Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello, and our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.